Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 70, Creating with Vader.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiT.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you are tuned into This Week in Law, TWiT, here on twit.tv. We record live at 11 o'clock every Friday, and today is Friday, July 23rd. And we have a really special show for you, because joining us for the first time ever, his inaugural appearance on TWiT, we're so excited to have our very own Leo Laporte. Hello, Leo.
Hi, Denise. Is it really? I don't know if this is my first. I think I've been on TWiT before.
You probably just feel like you have, because I'm sure you've listened to all of our 69 episodes to this one.
you sure I've never been on before?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
All right.
I don't know. You know, my memory and creativity are fading daily, we'll just have to trust on my recollection at the moment. Oh, and Leo, I do have a treat for you.
You do?
Oh, she's on a ball, and I'm in a chair.
You're off the ball, and I'm on the ball.
I feel so terrible. Isn't it great? Is this new for you?
Wonderful. It's actually great. It is. In your honor, I dragged it up from the gym, and you're right. It's a great way to do a show. So,
careful. Don't sit on a yoga ball, though, because those pop. You got to have an anti-burst stability ball.
Uh-oh. Well.
I bet that's a yoga ball. It is. It's a yoga. Oh, you're running. You're crazy.
Got to add excitement to the show somehow. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's sitting on a seagrass rug, too, so who knows what could poke up from down there. Also with us is Nilay Patel from Engadget. Hi, Nilay. Thanks for coming back on TWiT.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Great to have you. And Evan Brown from Hinshaw & Culbertson and internetcases.com. Hi, Evan.
Well, hello. Great to talk with you. Thanks for having me back.
My very great pleasure. So lots to talk about. Actually, Leo, I was wondering, listening to all of the AntennaGate coverage, I was certain that we would find a TWiT angle for it, because of course there's a TWiT angle for everything. And we actually did. I wanted to just bring it up real quick because of the finger pointing that has gone on to the other handset makers. And the press conference last week where Steve demonstrated that you could lose or degrade signal by holding various other phones in a death grip sort of way. And he's gotten some heat this week from those other handset makers about that. And actually looking at it, these people seem to be upset enough that, I'm just speculating. I haven't seen anybody take any further action on it. But it seems to me when you're going around saying that someone's handset has performance that is lower than it might actually be, that you could be subjecting yourself to some trade libel liability there. So I wanted to bring that up and ask our lawyers and ex-lawyers, recovering lawyers on the panel, what they think of that. Let's start with Nilay.
Well, I think the problem, all these, they're all responding. We actually just covered Samsung in the UK is going out to sort of influencers, social marketing people, publishing people on Twitter who are complaining about their iPhone 4 and handing out free Galaxy S phones and saying, this will solve your reception problems. They're running ads that, you know, the L in hello is replaced by a signal meter that's full. So all these companies are responding. And they're responding, I think, in a way that's appropriate for them to respond by saying, you know, we don't have this problem. You know, Apple's being stupid. And they're doing it through marketing. If they went legal, they started filing cases. They did C&Ds for Apple's videos on YouTube or whatever. I think they would be subject to much harsher scrutiny, because the problem they actually have is that their phones do what Apple says. And, you know, we've been, you know, now it's funny that since this has happened, we've had to test every single phone that we get for to see if you can death grip it. And for example, Samsung's phones, the Galaxy S phones, which are high-end Android phones just launched, they actually have the problem almost as badly as the iPhone 4, where if you grip it in the lower left corner, the signal just goes away. And, you know, there are hundreds of videos on YouTube. We are review units. I'll do it. HTC, same deal with the Droid Air. I mean, Apple's not wrong when they say it's an industry-wide problem. Where they're sort of fudging is by saying, you know, people are only noticing it because it's the iPhone 4. It's different on the iPhone 4 because, the antenna is external, and you can just touch it and make it happen. But the truth of the matter is that if you hold any phone, the wrong way, and I put the wrong way in quotes, you can make the signal drop. There's no, I can do it to every single phone I have here. I can even do it to, my prototype Windows 7 phone, which nobody else in the world has, right? So, I wonder if going legal for these companies is the right strategy, because once they start being subject to harsher scrutiny outside of just, marketing and kind of laughs and, going at the consumer to fight back against this perception, I don't know that their case will actually stand up.
I'm holding the Droid X here. And this has a bump, as a lot of phones do, right at the top there where the antenna is. And, there's a really good article today in Slate by Farhad Manju, in which he says, other phones have this problem, but you have to hold them in ungainly ways. He makes, I think, a really good point. I think all these companies need to come forward and be more transparent with regard to dropped calls, with regard to connectivity. It's not whether the bars go down. I'm sure Neil would agree with me. It's not whether the bars go down. Yeah. It's whether you drop a call. And, Apple admits they drop more calls on the iPhone 4. They say one more per 100, which could be, depending on what it looks like, it's probably twice as bad because the best guess is that AT&T is dropping about 1.4 calls per 100. So one more is 2.4. That's a lot worse. So Apple's admitting, in fact, that they first said this is the, in fact, when he went on stage, Steve Jobs said this phone, the iPhone 4, is the best, has the best reception we've ever made. And they had to admit, no, in fact, it's the worst we've ever made. But it really comes down to dropping calls, not bars, that's really the issue.
Right. Well, I think, the thing about that best reception we've ever made versus dropped calls is when this was all happening, we ran out and surveyed a lot of people who'd been reviewing the phone and living with the phone in the tech industry that sort of we could trust, right? And it turns out everybody sees the dropped bars. And it's just like you said, Leo, very few people see the dropped calls.
That's what matters.
Right. And, it's funny. I'm convinced that I'm a mutant of some kind because I can kill the reception. Now that I try, I can kill the reception on any phone. And even when I put the electrical tape around the bottom of the phone and put the iPhone in a bumper, I can still make it drop two bars.
Well, that's why there's no defamation case, because he was right. It is an industry-wide problem.
Oh, yes. It's funny that Apple has, this is their game now. They have to. I think it was Scott Adams who read Dilbert, who said, you can make a joke unfunny. It's really funny when you have a phone that you hold it a certain way and it drops calls, and that's hilarious. Once you show that it's every phone, it's just kind of boring. And I think
article he wrote, by the way. Right. He calls it the high ground maneuver.
Right, right.
And Steve executed.
And they did it in a way that's pretty classically Apple, right? It felt arrogant. They felt angry and defensive. But I mean, on the other hand, this is a multi-billion-dollar product for them, and it kind of makes sense that they're a little defensive about it. I don't know, defamation. Is HTC going to turn around and sue Apple? I think they have enough legal issues with Apple right now, and I think every Android handset maker right now is a little concerned that Apple's about to sue them. So I don't know if anybody's going to go after Apple and their $45 billion cash reserve in a lawsuit context, because it'll end in, a very sad settlement where everybody promises not to run these ads. And nobody wants to be talking about this. I guarantee you that all these manufacturers would rather run ads promoting their features and not our phones connect to the network, because, they've got problems with their networks too. AT&T and Verizon aren't perfect.
Yeah, you guys are giving me a couple of thoughts on this. First is, there's another really good article by J.R. Raphael at PC World, mm-hmm. Where he goes through and talks about how these are unparalleled comparisons to the other phones because, for example, the Droid Aris, he points out you have to hold it way up on top. And there's actually something in their manual that says, don't hold the phone like this. You know, it's an upfront warning. It may impair call quality and cause your device to operate at a higher power level than needed. Avoiding contact with the phone area when the phone is in use optimizes the antenna performance and the battery life. So, you know, it seems like they're at least being upfront about where the problem is. And for Apple to suggest that this is a apples to apples comparison, it just plain isn't accurate if you know, you take all this at face value. So strategically, I think I agree with you that getting into a bunch of lawsuits about these accusations is probably not where these companies are going to go. But I think it's some pretty interesting thin lines that Apple has decided to walk here on this particular issue. And Leo, what you said about needing more transparency, there's where I think we may get a lawsuit angle in the long run. You know, as more and more consumers look at this and more information comes out about it, perhaps it's the handset makers in general that need to fear some sort of consumer class action about the antenna performance issue, that perhaps this has been represented as more than they can actually deliver. Evan, do you think this is going anywhere?
No, I don't. And, you know, the nuance that is that we're seeing here, you know, you just described it as going out on some thin lines or use that expression somehow on all of this. All the nuance when we're talking about whether or not this is really true or whether it's a misrepresentation of what the other manufacturer's performance is like, it's that fact that underscores why litigation would not be a good idea in all of this, not just because that would make litigation difficult, very factually based. You know, for example, defamation. You'd have to show, you know, whether these are really false statements, how and to what extent it harmed Apple's reputation. If we're going to be talking about defamation or trade libel, you know, there would also be something. You know, the other manufacturers could fashion some kind of false advertising claim. You know, like a Lanham Act 43A kind of claim. And even if the statements aren't literally false, they could be misleading. You know, those are just questions that nobody wants to spend any time thinking about, any more time thinking about this. There's so many other larger picture issues, and you know, the fact that everybody is having issues like this, you know, it just means, you know, let's just carry on, and in 2 weeks let's not be talking about this anymore, and that's how these things go. It'll just be, you know, the meme for this week, I hope, and then we'll move on to something else really soon.
Yeah, my audience says no more antenna gate, we're so sick of this. You know, what's really happening, truthfully, in the larger scheme of things, is we're making a shift from personal computing and laptops and desktops to computing on these phones on networks that were never designed for the kind of traffic that we're sending them. You know, we just found out that Verizon's getting 5 times the traffic on the Droid X that they've ever got, the data traffic. None of these networks are going to be able to handle this. You're going to see a lot of upset from consumers who are paying, you know, thousands of dollars over 2 years for these things. And yet they're all moving to them. I think this is just kind of the normal dislocation when there's a big paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift is from desktop and laptop computing to small mobile computing. And it's a big shift. I'm sure Nilay is seeing that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's exactly right. It's, you know, there are things that you would never dream of doing to a television antenna, right? Because you just know not to do it. I mean, nobody gets mad because you can't, you know, go and stand in front of your TV antenna and stick it under your shirt and then you don't get reception. Right, I think it's just a matter of learning how this stuff actually works and educating the consumer. And you know, it's funny you're saying, you know, these networks are never built for it. Both Verizon and AT&T are, you know, they're trying to shift their next generation networks as quickly as possible. And one of the reasons for that, it's not just to be competitive. It's because those networks have so much more bandwidth, right. And they're also lobbying the FCC for more spectrum. I mean, they know. I mean, we were just talking about this on the Engadget podcast. And these networks are not, it's not like your ISP at home, right, where you get a dumb pipe. mean, you plug it in, you can do whatever you want with it. They have very, very limited amounts of bandwidth and very limited amounts of spectrum. And so all these devices being plugged in at once, the carriers are freaking out. I mean, they don't know exactly what they can do to ration this stuff. So they're trying everything they can, get more spectrum, build new networks. And as we make that transition, I think we're going to see more little inflection points where we learn that it's not just AT&T that's bad in dropping your calls, but, you know, the device plays a part too. And, you know, these companies have to... Go ahead.
Steve revealed something very interesting at this press conference. He said that it takes AT&T 3 years to get an approval for a right-of-way for a cell tower in San Francisco. Well, of course, San Francisco's terrible. It takes them 3 years. So it's a whole bunch of conflicting problems that all pile up. And we as consumers are just blithely going along saying, well, of course I'm going to have the same connectivity on my portable device as I walk down the street as I have at my home. That's nuts. We take this stuff for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and here in Southern California, the AT&T issues are not nearly as bad as what you deal with up north. So, yeah,
I finally gave up on the iPhone in the Bay Area. It just dropped too many calls for me. Far more than 2 in 100, more like 1 in 2. And Verizon doesn't do the same thing yet. Now everybody's got a Droid X. It might.
Okay, well, another story that I've discussed both with Nilay and Leo in other contexts and with Evan too here on the show is the Jason Chen antenna. We can now put the nail in that coffin, the Jason Chen antenna, excuse me, the subpoena that was issued by the React folks up there in Northern California, going after his computers. And, of course, the Shield Law ramifications that came up from all that. I'd say we, as journalists, we chalk this one up as a victory, that Chen and Gizmodo were able to challenge this and back down the subpoena and get it withdrawn by the prosecutor. Because that could have been dangerous.
I don't want to... Gizmodo are, you know, they're obviously fierce competitors of Engadget, and I don't want to say too much about specifically their case.
And you guys turned down the phone,
right? So I mean, I'm not going to comment on sort of that sort of stuff. But you know, when you say it's a victory, you know, I think it was actually from a legal perspective. I don't know that it was just done in the name of efficiency, right? Because that Shield Law, you know, was really overbroad. I mean, it basically says if you're a journalist, the law enforcement can't touch you, right? And I don't know that the DA was going to just let that run and not litigate that and not say, we need to appeal this, we need to take this to the appellate level and say that, you know, we have to carve out an exception here. And that would have taken years and dragged this out for years. I think just in the name of efficiency, they said, let's cut a deal and move on to the merits here because those are important. And I think I'm assuming from Gawker's perspective, they felt the same way, that there's no reason to litigate the Shield Law when, you know, we think we're on the right and we think that we acted appropriately here. I'm sure they think they acted appropriately. And we want to argue that case and not the case of whether the Shield Law is overbroad or whether it has an exception to it. So, you know, it's a victory in the sense that the case is moving forward, that the prosecutor doesn't feel that, you know, they have the ability to just throw these warrants out left and right. But I think in sort of a real sense, in a practical sense, maybe I'm wrong. Evan can speak to that a little better than me. I've been out of the game.
Yeah. Well, it's...
Yeah, Evan, you had a bet on this one that no one was going to get prosecuted ever. And so far, it hasn't happened.
He wins the bet.
So you're doing right. Well.
It looks like we don't have to worry about Gizmodo at least getting sued or anybody from there getting arrested. You know, we still got to worry about the guys who... may have taken it from the bar and then, you know, offered it up for sale. Mm-hmm. Nilay hit it, right on when he said this is, you know, for the sake of efficiency and just like any kind of dispute, whether it be a civil lawsuit or a plea bargain in a criminal type of situation, this largely sounds like a settlement. And, I don't think we should get too much into real hair splitting on whether it's a victory or what. It certainly is not a defeat. We certainly haven't seen anything chipped away from these statutory protections, you know, for the journalist here. So, yes, I'm still surprised to see it's still kicking around at all. But, you know, in as much as it is still kicking around. I'm glad to see this is a development. And, you know, I remain skeptical that that there will ever be an arrest of the guys who may have taken it from the guy who may have taken it from a bar and his alleged accomplices. So that's it. You know, efficiency. It's right there.
Why do you say that, Evan? Is it because you feel like it'd be an impossible case to put together, or?
Yeah, I think it's just too factually
challenged.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I get maybe there's some great stuff that is on the server, you know, Jason Chen's server that they'll find out here. And now, you know, that the ability to search for that is going to be much more constrained because the way I understand it, Gizmodo is just going to be providing certain documents rather than having, you know, the ability to look at this, look at these data, you know, carte blanche or, you know, open book.
Isn't that how the Shield Law was supposed to work all along? Was we'll give you the relevant data, but you can't just do a fishing expedition in my materials.
Right. Got to have some kind of real reason to have an articulable reason, you know, to go after it, making sure that right. You're not just going to put, you know, because journalists are in a real vulnerable position here. Not only, you know, do we want to encourage, you know, their investigative efforts, and therefore, you know, have these shield laws so that there will be these protections and not having the police knocking on the door every moment. But, you know, with that comes a great vulnerability, and that all of these things kind of blend into one objective here. And that's, you know, what these shield laws do a great job of accomplishing, I think.
So I wanted to toss a couple of numbers out to the panel for discussion. First one, $100 million so far spent by Google in its litigation against Viacom. Now, that seems to have been well spent, at least in the short term. They won this huge motion for summary judgment where they are able to avail themselves of the safe harbors of the DMCA and protect themselves for liability for their users uploading copyrighted works. So far, so good. But appeals will come after this, and we haven't seen the end of that story. And it's just such an enormous number that they released. And I wonder, Nilay, if you have any thoughts on that or how you would feel as a Google shareholder about that kind of a number in this kind of a context. Was it worth the money?
You know, from Google's perspective, it obviously was, right? Even though YouTube doesn't really make them a lot of money, YouTube is obviously, there's got to be a way to make money off of YouTube, right? I mean, I think we all agree on that. So the fact that YouTube is allowed to continue to exist and operate in the way that it does, that's great. If I was a Viacom shareholder, I would be seriously angry. Because
they
haven't
exactly released that number.
Right, but I don't doubt that Viacom spent a similar amount of money, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm certain they have equally elite law firms spending an equal amount of time, right? So, and, you know, discovery is never cheap, and there's obviously been a ton of discovery here. So if I was a Viacom shareholder, I'd be wondering, well, okay, well, you've blown all this money, you've lost. It's not like it's easy for Viacom to just turn around $100 million right now, right? That there's a semi-struggling media company. And why haven't you just been making a deal with Google to monetize these assets on YouTube all along? And it's such a huge blunder for them to have spent all this money litigating in, you know, an effort to control something that I think we all agree is really hard to control, when they should have been, you know, exercising the ability to do a deal, monetize, and expand their distribution. And that to me is like Viacom saying, we don't want Walmart to sell our CDs anymore, we're going to sue Walmart, when they don't realize that that's how most people get their CDs, right? I mean, it's just backwards to me. From Google's perspective, they're winning, right? I mean, they're doing everything they need to do. They're defending themselves, they're defending their product, they're saying we're within the confines of the law, which for Google is crazy, right? Because Google generally just does whatever they want, and they're like, we'll litigate it out later. So, I mean, that strategy is working for them. For Viacom, what have they accomplished? It's virtually nothing.
Right, except for the opportunity to spend lots and lots more money on appeal, which they undoubtedly will. Leo, right. any thoughts on this?
Two thoughts. One, that all the other big media companies are going, whew, we're glad we didn't sue. Viacom took the bullet for them. And as a user, I'm grateful to Google for spending $100 million because I'm not a lawyer. I'm the non-legal mind on this panel. But it strikes me that they've struck a blow for the safe harbor provisions of the DMCA. They've solidified that. And that's really good news for end users and for anybody who creates content or has a, you know, a chat room or a, you know, message board on the internet. That's good news. So thank you, Google, for spending the money. And I'm sure Warner Brothers is thanking Viacom.
Well, I mean, if you look at what Google is doing here, it's sort of the fringes of their IP litigation is kind of now it's adding up to being a pervasive sort of like attitude that they have. I mean, Google Books settlement is that's crazy. It's still crazy to me. It's crazy to me that that's what they did. And that's how they're like, we're going to scan every book and then we'll just litigate until you give up.
That was a little different. Yeah. That, but, you know, remember that in the discovery of this Viacom case, one of the things we learned is that Google was very aware of the potential litigation against YouTube, and they felt that they could win. Right. They wouldn't have spent whatever $3.1 billion on YouTube to begin with. They believed it was a defensible position, so they had to spend the additional $100 million. I mean, that's a fraction of what they paid for YouTube to get that opinion. I suppose that this could go on forever in appeals, and we haven't seen the end of the spending. But
You know, and the facts for Viacom were also really bad because it kept on coming out that Viacom employees were uploading Viacom content.
It's like
no judge is gonna look at that and be like, all right, well, you win. Like, you can't do that. That doesn't make any sense.
Just nitwits. They were just nitwits.
Evan, aside from all the spending that's going to continue to go on in this case and other cases, how ultimately are these entertainment and content generating companies going to get themselves paid in the future? Because right now, you know, their litigation strategy is not working on a number of fronts. So are we moving toward a world where there is some kind of tax, where there is some kind of mandatory or negotiated arrangement with ISPs, the third-party providers that would be covered by this ruling in the Viacom YouTube case? Where are we going with all this?
Well, clearly it's got to be some variation of the class of things that you just enumerated here, because this is belaboring the obvious, but the distribution model is irrevocably changed. And there's a great post from back in January in our discussion points today from one of the guys in OK Go that addresses this point of the fundamental change in the way that content, you know, particularly music in that context was being described. It used to be sold in chunks. And this is an idea we've talked about before, but, you know, these tangible, fungible chunks of things were sold, namely CDs, and before that cassettes, and before that vinyl. And that's something that, because of its existence in the physical world, is something that's easy to count and easy to sell and easy to account for. Now, content being just generally available, streaming out there in the cloud, there's got to be some way of replacing what has been lost in the adoption or the proliferation of that model that it was taken out when the chunk or the tangible thing that can be counted and accounted for was removed. Some kind of connection between the experience of the end user wanting to consume this content, wanting to acquire rights to this content, you know, at least in the smallest instance, the right to listen to it. There's got to be a way of replacing that connection between end user and creative work that thus far we just don't have a good model for, but it's in the nature of those things that you mentioned, some kind of tax, some kind of flat fee, something, you know, based on how much of this stuff you want to consume, a monthly subscription fee, some kind, you know, per hour, you know, some kind of time-based model. Your guess is as good as mine as to what in particular that's going to be, but clearly it's got to be something of that ilk.
Yeah, I'm just worried that on the way to that kind of a world, we're going to wind up spending a lot more for the things that we're consuming than people want to or have otherwise been used to spending as we get, you know, nicked by Netflix and Pandora, and now this company Mog is launching their service soon. How many $35 a year or $9.95 a month right. are people really going to be able to tolerate? And how much is really justified?
How are we going to be able to qualify the nature of the experience and then thereby quantifying it as well? Because there's nothing to count anymore. It's much more subjective, perhaps. And, we won't know whether our disdain for paying what we think is too much is actually valid and true. It's just one of those things that I guess the market will have to somehow shake it out.
Well, every time we cover a new subscription service at Engadget, sort of the question we always ask is, or our readers ask, or somebody on our staff asks, is this going to kill cable? Can I get rid of my cable now? So Hulu Plus launches, and everybody says, can I get rid of my cable? Or Netflix comes to more devices, and they say, well, I can get rid of my cable now. And most people don't get rid of their cable. For example, in the case of Hulu Plus, it's, well, now you're paying to watch Hulu on your TV. But it turns out, Hulu is all network content, right? So you're not really, in terms of first-run material, you're not really getting much more than you would if you just plugged a DVR into an antenna and called it a day, right? It's all over the air. Mm-hmm. I think the cable companies actually have a huge opportunity here, right? Because they're already built into your lifestyle, right? So you get a new house, the first thing you do is you call the cable company, and you get internet and cable and maybe a telephone if you're 90. So Comcast, they're doing on-demand streaming to all these services. I can log in with my computer to Fancast and get on-demand. And they really haven't promoted it. I mean, they're not doing a great job of pushing it out there, but it's there. And it's theirs to lose. I think that the market is, it's growing, and you've got companies like Boxy, and you've got Hulu and Netflix and all these other streaming companies. And they're saying, well, look at all the stuff. You can get rid of your cable. Well, just like TiVo, all Comcast or Time Warner have to do is say, well, as part of your cable subscription, we're offering you on-demand access on your phone. And then nobody is even going to think about these other services ever again. And I think that's, they're slowly waking up to it. They'll get there.
That's the point of this ultraviolet DRM. I don't know if it's going to take off, but they announced it this week.
Tell us about that. That's a new one on me.
This is the really poorly named, digital ecosystem content engine, or what? Maybe Neil knows the name of this, but DECE, they're an industry group, and they've got a DRM that everybody is a signatory to now that allows you to buy it on one service, say a Comcast, and then play it on another service. So say you buy it on Amazon, now you've got the digital rights to it, and you can play it back on your Comcast box. There is one little catch. Apple and Disney haven't agreed to it, so it's a big hole.
They have their own competing system called KeyChest, and I would venture a guess that if they're smart, I think probably around CES time. CES, for some reason, there always seem to be really hilarious DRM announcement at CES that the industry wants us to be excited about, and we're always like, well, it's a DRM announcement. No one has ever
Everybody
been excited. I don't know what you're expecting here. Like, we're very proud of you.
Nice job.
There it is. Way to keep locking.
Yeah, the only
down.
Kind of DRM announcements that get applause are when people like Amazon get rid of it, or Apple following in there.
Our Michael Gartenberg, who I'm sure you all know, writes a column for us, and he's always telling me that DRM to protect old business models is what people are mad about. DRM to enable new business models, nobody ever has a problem with.
Right.
So everybody loves Netflix. Netflix is one of the most hardcore DRM services out there. But nobody ever blinks about it. I mean, I think the only time I've ever had a problem with Netflix DRM is when they first launched all their streaming devices, and I had like 50 Netflix streaming devices here, and they were all plugged in, and the DRM server freaked out. But who else has that problem? I mean, that's a very limited DRM problem.
It's when the DRM starts to get in the way of other uses. I mean, one big criticism of it is you can't make a fair use of a copyrighted work, if you have to crack the DRM. So I don't know that anybody, if they stop and think about it long enough, is going to think that DRM is inherently bad. It's when it becomes an obstacle for the kind of uses that you want to make. And right now Netflix is relatively easy to use, so those objections don't even come into the forefront of people's minds. There's nothing, no blockage there.
There are lots of other models too, by the way. I always think back to that silly wedding video, remember, where they came dancing down the aisle, and it had a Chris Brown song on in the background. And YouTube offers this great facility for rights holders to yank it. And by the way, we've had videos yanked. I think you've had videos yanked too, Denise, because we, I think in my opinion as a non-lawyer, in a perfectly fair use way as a news organization.
That means a much more sensible one.
We'll play clips from a copyrighted materials as an illustration. We were about to play the OK Go video, for instance, as an illustration of what we're talking about. And YouTube's automatic content system is very quick at catching that stuff, warning about it, and then the rights holder can pull it down. In this case, the people who own the rights to the Chris Brown song said, no, you can put up an ad for the song. Chris Brown's song, which was several years old, got back on the charts, sold hundreds of thousands more copies. He made a ton of money. YouTube is always an opportunity to sell more product. It is not a negative. And it's the fact that Viacom, on the one hand, is suing them, and on the other hand, knew this and was promoting, their own employees were promoting stuff on YouTube, illustrates this point. This doesn't mean they can't make money. It just means they're holding on to that old business model, as you said.
Well, I think Chris Brown's people were also really excited that his track was getting some positive publicity.
Yeah, right.
That's right when he was like going to jail.
It's good timing.
Excellent timing. And then it was on the Office, which which it probably wouldn't have been, but for all that success on YouTube.
Exactly. So, yeah. And look, you could point to The Daily Show has been a huge beneficiary of YouTube. I think Saturday Night Live got revitalized by YouTube. People thought Saturday Night Live wasn't funny anymore until they started seeing clips on YouTube and they said, oh, maybe it's back. It's a great promotional vehicle. And any corporate entity that thinks, it's bad for business is nuts.
Yeah, I hope that as the years go by, we get some really good empirical science going on about this benefit of what it means in terms of increased revenue or harm, if that's what the downside of this is, from kind of a viral sort of exposure of content. Because it seems, and I'm certainly no expert on the science that has been done on this question so far, of whether it's good for the bottom line to put content out there for free and to be distributed without any kind of restriction. But the science that we do see seems to just really be divergent. You've got big content interpretation of the facts, and then you've got the more individualist view, the rights of the end user to be able to share, the proponents of that. And it just seems that these set of facts lend themselves so readily to manipulation and spin that it's really hard to get a clear picture, because we can point to situations like the wedding entrance with the Chris Brown song and trace it down the line to see, extraordinary increases in revenues for big media. But I think just as easily we could probably go out there and find situations where piracy, and I really hate using that word because of the connotation of it, but I'm sure that we can very easily, if we set our minds to it and hone in on looking for situations like this, we can see where piracy really has done some harm. And so therefore there's a great detraction that occurs when music is distributed without restriction. So I just hope that there can be a reasoned and very principled view on this, because this issue really, it's clearly a factual issue. It's just very much based in statistics and economics, but it really is an integral issue that informs the legal analysis in all of this, because it translates then into areas of copyright reform. And even if we're not going to rewrite the Copyright Act to more suitably address new digital media, it should at least inform and perhaps modify the notions and sensibilities and ways that courts will look to questions of fair use. So it is not an insignificant question, and it's one that, unlike the issues surrounding Antennagate, this will stay with us for a while, I hope.
It's funny because we have, I call them the whippersnappers of the Engadget staff, who really, I argue with them all the time about the idea that, you own content, right? I mean, it's actually a foreign idea to sort of a one generation younger than me, right? If you're 20, 21, 22, the idea that you own content and you the people who made the Hurt Locker shouldn't actually sue 1,000 people for stealing it. And that's the people who made the Hurt Locker are actually in the wrong, and the people who are distributing it, you know, in an unauthorized way are somehow right. That's, you know, that's backwards from the traditional view. And here's the thing. Somebody eventually has to pay, right? And I think that's the root of this problem, is that somebody eventually has to pay for content to be made, and you have to be able to sell it. And without some sort of scarcity, it's very hard to price something and then sell it. And so if we just give up on the idea of controlled distribution, which is what creates scarcity, then we've given up on the ability to price products. And then we live in a world that's like ad-supported or subscription-supported. And that's fine. Maybe the subscription model is the way to go. But very, like, on a personal level, like, I'm actually scared of living in a world that's entirely supported by ads. I don't, that idea doesn't appeal to me. Every now and again, I realize that Google's real business is like selling ads, and that I've turned over my entire email life, which is pretty much my life, to like a company that wants to sell me ads. And that's a little bit terrifying. I mean, to say that everything in the world should be financed by large corporations who want to sell you a physical object, because that's what they want to do, right? So it's, you know, you want to view an intangible object like a music video on YouTube. Well, you have to sit through an ad for something that you have to go out and buy. You have to sit through a car ad. So the idea that the sales of sort of physical objects will, you know, fuel the or fund the development of IP is really backwards to me. I mean, that's not how our world works. I mean, I write for a living. Like, why should I wait for the soap company to like totally fund everything that I do? It seems backwards. It does for me on Engadget, right?
Yeah,
but like
it does.
No, but it does. But
if people are going to pay for Engadget, you got another thing coming. They're not. What happened to the paywall in England with the Times, where they dropped, 95% of their audience disappeared as soon as they put up a paywall.
So, but Leo, you're arguing that every bit of creativity in this world should be funded like Engadget.
No, I'm not at all.
I mean, I totally agree with you. I get Engadget. But if I wanted to write a book, if I wanted to write a screenplay, if I wanted to write a song, I have to sit around and wait for the dishwasher company to come and pay me.
And I think everybody who consumes content, look at how much do you pay for content this month? You paid more, I guarantee you, and everybody listening paid more for content this month than they paid 10 years ago. I guarantee you. We are not paying less for content. We are paying far more. People understand that if they want HBO and they want great music, they're going to have to pay the artists. They know that. And we are spending more on content than ever before. Every metric says that.
I think the metric says that we're spending more on different kinds of services, right? Because that's what I'm spending more on. I'm spending more.
Where's the difference? What's the distinction between the content?
Because I'm not running out and buying CDs, right?
You don't buy more music now than you bought 5 years ago, anyway?
Actually, I don't, to be perfectly honest. I used to buy vinyl records. I mean, I'm that guy, and I just don't do that anymore.
Well, that's because you're getting old. But but I think a lot of people buy more music than ever before because these new distribution methods make it easier, and point of access is huge. The fact that I can push a button and for 99 cents have a record makes a big difference in sales. And to your point, Evan, I think the only studies that say otherwise are studies funded by the record industry who would like to prove that DRM works. In every case, whether you talk to Cory Doctorow, you talk to I've talked to a lot of authors who've given away manuscripts or worked on manuscripts online and have offered paid versions, and in almost every case that I've ever heard of, they sell more, not less.
Mm-hmm.
You think appealing to people's better judgment like that is the answer? So you could have this for free and you can pay me if you want to, because that's what giving your manuscript away for free really does, right? You have to love this enough to pay.
Recognizing that the internet is a fantastic publicity medium, that YouTube is this happens every time. You know, the people who made piano rolls got sued by the musicians because the musicians say, oh no, you're stealing our music. And this happens every time. Jack Valenti said the VCR was to the movie industry as the boss right. Strangler was the woman home alone. Mm-hmm. You never want to ask existing businesses if the new stuff is good for them. It's not, because it's a paradigm shift. But think about it. YouTube is a fantastic publicity medium. People do pay more for content. There's every evidence that this is a good thing for artists. Every bit of evidence. I don't think the only people don't like it are the guys who hold on.
Is a creative solution that both takes into account the whole smorgasbord of distribution channels available and the economics so that right. it winds up making sense for people. And they're not perpetually paying more and more for what used to be, you know, a baseline level of content and entertainment delivery. And the industry that is spending $17 million on legal fees in 2008 to collect some $300,000 in fees from their customers, the downloaders, is not, you know, not giving me a whole lot of faith that they're going to be creative enough to come up with that solution.
You know, to Leo's point, William Patrie, who's the general counsel of Google, wrote a terrific book called Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, which he directly referenced that Jack Valenti quote. And basically his thesis is that every time the copyright owners are threatened throughout history, what they will say is the kids right. are morally wrong. Right. They don't understand the concept of ownership. We are going to corrupt society. We're going to destroy creativity. And the only way to solve it is by giving us more control over creative work. And, you know, Leo, I'm completely in agreement with you. This book is terrific. I recommend it to everyone. It's really well argued.
It's a favorite.
Yes, it is, definitely.
Oh, really?
Oh, Professor Patrie, definitely. Well, I mean, we've never recommended it on Audible. Unfortunately, it's not there. But there are lots of occasions when it's come up on the show. And I would like to get into the whole topic of creativity and the kids and where they are going. But before I do that, I would like to thank our sponsors at Audible and give a plug to the folks who are going to launch us into this creativity discussion. This is a favorite book and favorite duo of authors on Twill. We have recommended this as an Audible pick before. And it is the book Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. And I thought because we have recommended that one before, we'd also throw in that you should check out What Should I Do With My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question, also by Poe Bronson, and The Nudist on the Late Shift, which is one of my really favorite anecdotal group of stories about the way things used to be in 1999 or so in Silicon Valley. And all of those are available on Audible. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, any of those can be yours for free. You'll be signed up for the Audible Gold Listener Program. And every month you'll get a credit for a free book. Actually, for $14.95 per month, you will get a credit for a book. And it's a great program where you can get more like this of really insightful and wonderful writing. These three are a great way to get started on Audible. Leo, I know you've read Nurture Shock before and are also a big fan. Oh, there it is. Yes. It's an absolutely great book. I recommended this to every parent in my son's class at school. And, you know, it took off virally. I think every parent in the school wound up reading it. And we've actually given it to the principal, too, and have gotten sort of a resounding silence because it calls for a lot of change in the way people think about children and education. So go out if you have not read it. Download it for free on Audible by going to audiblepodcast.com/twill. And thanks so much, Audible, for your support. So Mr. Bronson and Ms. Merriman have been busy writing for Newsweek and have a report out now about creativity and how, for the first time, it appears it is declining in America. And this is a subject that is near and dear to our hearts here at Twill, since so much of the law that we talk about and discuss and the developments in law depends upon people's creativity and pushing the boundaries of existing law. So to read about this was sort of disturbing, and yet it makes perfect sense to me that as ourselves and our children spend more and more time dealing with things in a DRM'd environment where it's difficult to pull something out and recreate it and reuse it, where, you know, you're vegetating in front of a computer screen and not really having an interaction with what's going on there, because maybe the screen is now an iPad and it's difficult to use that as a device to interact with what's present there. So it's kind of a wake-up call for how we need to pay attention to making sure that creativity flourishes and the things that we can do to make that happen. Evan, did you take a look? And what do you think of all this?
There's so much interesting stuff in this article. And I think at the end of the day, what we need to realize is that we need some meta creativity here to, you know, a creative solution for fixing the trend in this decline of creativity. And, you know, so there's all kinds of ways of thinking about how this, you know, decline could affect us. And it leads us to think of the nature of creativity and what we can do to enhance that and keep the decline from happening, and also talk about the nature of creativity itself. And I had a number of observations on this, and I think one that's you know, particularly interesting, or I guess, you know, particularly interesting to me is my observation. So I had it. Of course, it's interesting, right? with our modern life, you know, there is so much standardization and homogenization. That is because of the advances we have had in technology and all the way across the board, from the ways that information can be transmitted to everyone instantaneously, you know, all the way to, you know, Wikipedia, it's all out there, all the way to frozen food, to, you know, prefab shelving, you know, all that stuff. You know, all we have now are just, well, it's not all that we have, but in large part are the unthinking life and the easy consumer life is just a series of activities of just taking modules and plugging them in to parts in our life, and there's less time for, you know, detailed less opportunities for detailed reflection or detailed opportunities to craft a solution to a problem. It's just something that you can go out and find the answer or you know, buy something to do there. So, I mean, if you think about, you know, in the old days, you know, each family or each individual would have to fashion a particular solution to the problems that they faced in life. Now that is gone. So the irony of this is that all of the standardization and homogenization has come about because of, you know, the upsurge in the benefits that, you know, thousands, at least hundreds of years of creative thinking have gotten us, you know, to this point in life. And so here we are now, and it's almost as if we've become so advanced that we rely too much on the fruits of that advancement to our detriment. A couple of different things I could say. I don't want to talk too much about all this, but there are also some really interesting implications into, you know, a career, and in particular, the practice of law, which, contrary to many people's impression, I think can be an endeavor that that can allow one's creativity to flourish despite the outward appearances that many lawyers give. So
I'm sure that Scott Adams moral high ground maneuver that he referenced struck me as very legal, that this would be something that you know, is something that lawyers aspire to, you know, as they are presenting their positions on behalf of clients and briefing and et cetera.
Right.
So, Leo, what do you think? Are we struggling with this creativity issue here? Are you worried about the future of American creativity in a world where things are more locked down, and the biggest problem that a family has to confront is how it's going to pay for the entertainment it wants to consume?
Well, I have two thoughts about this. First of all, the Torrance test that they use is 50 years old, and it could just very well be that it is less relevant as time goes by. And what, you know, this happens all the time. There's a cultural bias in testing. However, having said that, I mean, and Ashley's really good about collating research, and I think that perhaps there is a measurable decrease in creativity, at least on this test. I find that a little difficult to believe. I'm more in the Clay Shirky camp. His book, Here Comes Everybody, said, get ready, we're going to be in a creative boom. And, you know, there's, what is it, 24 hours of new videos uploaded to YouTube every minute now? I don't see any dearth of creativity. I don't see any evidence of this at all. I noticed that in the article, you know, there's a little bit of a tendency to say, oh, they're watching too much TV, playing too many video games. I've heard this all before. If I'm going to blame anything, I'm going to blame the school system, particularly here in California, but nationwide in the U.S. anyway, where creativity is a luxury, where they can't afford art and dance and theater, and so they stop doing it. And in fact, you know, our school systems increasingly look, you know, sclerotic. I think that they are, you know, becoming, it's almost like an 18th century educational system in a 21st century world. If you're going to blame anything, I think it's the school systems and the environment that this Torrance, which is the environment that this Torrance test is given in. But believe me, when you go to a Maker Fair or you look at YouTube or you look at the number of podcasts out there, I see no dearth of creativity at all. I don't see anything to worry about. In fact, it's the very same people that are saying this that are also saying there's too much stuff and I can't figure out. I'm overloaded. Well, yeah, that's called creativity. There's a lot of it.
Well, you know, from I'll stick to the Engadget angle here. I completely agree with Leo. I mean, every day at Engadget, we get tips from some 17-year-old high school kid who's like, I've invented a new product, and if only you put it on Engadget, I can find funding for it. And it's like, we get so many of them that we can't actually do it. But, you know, on a broader level, I mean, who are the companies that define our world? They're all American companies with very American leadership. It's Apple and Google and Microsoft, right? I mean, these companies are pushing the state of the art. They're actually showing our kids that American innovation is what you aspire to. And if you look at and this is a really bad example, and I don't want to sound jingoistic, but it's I find it amusing. If you look at what Samsung did to Android on the Galaxy S, it's like, well, maybe you should just leave it up to Google, guys. Because your design sense is like totally, totally miscalibrated.
Isn't that funny?
You know, and that's a cultural thing. And Samsung devices obviously do very well in Korea. So, but you know, it's if you look at what creativity is actually doing in the States and where innovation is coming from, sort of in my narrow perspective of the tech industry, it's very U.S. driven. I mean, this is where it's happening. And, you know, the best minds from around the world, they all want to come work at Apple. They all want to come work at Google. To a lesser extent, they all want to come work at Microsoft, right? And that's still something. I mean, you know, you we want to build it up more holistically from within our schools. I agree with Leo that, you know, our schools can probably do a better job of that. But, you know, on another level, it's these kids get out of school, they all pick up their cell phones, and they all make videos of themselves doing whatever.
I think that's
and that
creative.
Alone is a mm-hmm. is a really great, yeah. I mean, that's where it's happening. Yeah. And so we need to move that back into our schools for sure, but it's definitely happening outside of the school system.
Right. Yeah, and we've got to make, go ahead, Denise.
I was just going to say, there's a great example in the article of a school that has adopted a sort of a problem-solving curriculum approach, where instead of just going through and doing their subjects, they'll present the class with something at the school, such as the library's too noisy. How are we going to make the library acceptably quiet given all of the sound conditions around? And then they proceed to work on that problem and solve it. And it gets them through their entire required curriculum in going through all the various steps and coming up with ideas and implementing them, which I think sounds like a great way to go about it.
That's exactly what I wanted to address. And in all of this, we've got to be very conscientious of how we're defining what creativity is and, you know, what an acceptable creative result will be. I mean, we could have a bunch of content uploaded to YouTube every minute, but it could just be, you know, all, you know, the result of efforts that aren't creative, and it's, you know, low quality stuff. So I really was taken by you know, the discussion in this article, and found it very interesting from a you know, cognitive science perspective. I'm not a cognitive scientist, but, you know, I guess what I found interesting was the cognitive science look at this issue. The notion of creative thinking being the process of divergent thinking and then convergent thinking, where you're presented with a set of facts, a conundrum, a problem. You know, is it an engineering problem? Is it an artistic problem? You know, how do I render this painting on this canvas? Is it a legal problem? You know, how do I advocate this position given this set of facts? You know, no matter what it is, you look at it, and then, you know, one side of the brain will then go out there into the ether, so to speak, and hypothesize about potential solutions and bring back, potential good solutions back to the more rationalizing parts of the brain. And then there's this magical synthesis that happens. And that is the result of real creative endeavor. And I just love the image or the model of this notion of divergence and convergence. And, you know, there's some interesting ways of thinking about this and how this relates to what I was reminded of was an article I read, and I don't remember the names of the authors. I intended to look it up, but where how some real creative thinking can happen when there are actual constraints on the nature of the project, because you're given a more finite set of things to go out there and pick up in this divergent thinking. Some real world examples are Twitter. You know, people think one of the reasons Twitter is great and why there are people like Merlin Mann who can enhance their popularity on a medium through Twitter is because in 140 characters you're given a certain set of constraints there that make it more finite to go out and pick from. If it were something where it was more open and there was an unlimited set of characters, there wouldn't be as much creativity. A similar principle is in why search engines can work based on an index rather than just going and looking at every bit of content on the web as the query is made. Even Dante was talking about this in 1300. He was describing the term that he used in writing poetry was a certain curb, put on, which was implemented by the form or the structure that the work had to have. So Shakespeare's sonnets, for example, look a certain way because they are, constrained or curbed by iambic pentameter. So I just really, was taken by this notion, this cognitive view at it. And I think that can be very instructive, leading this back to the reason that we think about creativity and originality so much on this show. Really underlying, I think, the shorthand way of saying it is we are interested in the ways that it can inform and animate copyright law. And this then opens up a way of analyzing all of these problems that we've been talking about in the episode so far. How do you, incent creative expression? Is it all for the sake of money, as big content would say, or is it something that is more autotelic? The desire comes from within, as maybe what Aristotle would say.
Well, let me take it to copyright law pretty directly, right? So I love going to the Art Institute here in Chicago. And one of the things I always see is art students sitting in front of masterpieces, copying them to learn how to make them. And it happens all over the place. Copyright law sort of just lets that happen, right? I mean, the Art Institute isn't suing them. The works, mm-hmm. the copyright in these works has long since expired, right? But I don't see why kids now with the tools they have or people with the tools they have, they can't sit down and try to shot for shot remake things. And they do it all the time. They put it on YouTube or take the raw elements of a song and remix them, right? Like Girl Talk style. And that sort of stuff that's new. Those are new ideas. It's never happened before. And copyright law is kind of behind that curve. And so, I heard you just say, whether or not the content on YouTube is art or whether it's really creative, that's sort of, I, every time I hear that, my spidey sense ticks on. I feel like that's not really a valid, I don't mean to disagree with you this harshly, but I feel like that question sort of misses the point. It's people are making things, right? And throughout history, some people have made things well and some people have made things poorly. And I think the more people that you have making things in any context, you're going to, the numbers of people who make things well are going to go up. And especially if you expand it so that people who might not have otherwise made things or been creative, if you expand the tools and you democratize the tools so that everybody has the opportunity to make things, you might find that somebody who might not have otherwise created something has created something great. And I think that is actually where copyright law should go, to incentivize everybody to create. And then when the time comes to recognize some economic benefit, then the law steps in and says, okay, now we have to dole out, who's paying who. And I think that's sort of the role that I'd like to see copyright law go into. The role of we're literally controlling who can make copies, I think it's obviously falling apart as these tools are being more and more democratic. More and more, actually just easy to use, like fundamentally easy to use. My mother has never taken a video before. Now she has an iPhone. She's taking all kinds of videos. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well said.
Well, our tip of the week this week, it involves an aspect of creativity, perhaps. We're not sure. We'll have to see how it plays out in the litigation. But Zuckerberg at Facebook probably think it's fairly creative. A man named Paul D. Celia of Wellsville, New York, has filed a lawsuit against Facebook claiming that he owns 84% of the site based on a contract that Mark Zuckerberg signed 7 years ago. So I guess
I love
our tip
the story,
of
by the way. Yes. I truly love the story.
I guess our tip of the week is if you're going to found a social networking site that ultimately 7 years later will have 500 million users, do not sign a contract giving away ownership of 84% of said site. Just don't do it.
Has this contract been released? Has it been publicly disclosed or is it just?
Yes, it's attached to the complaint. It is.
I gotta get this. Yeah,
it appears to have a Zuckerberg signature on it, although Facebook is backing and filling and saying, well, we don't know that this is what it is.
They're saying it's a forgery now.
Yeah, yeah. Zuckerberg told Diane Sawyer that he's quite sure he didn't sign such a contract.
This is worthy of Melvin Dumar, if it's the case.
This is amazing. I have to say, this really points to everything about Facebook. I mean, you know, Facebook is great and... all of my friends use it and it's great to catch up with them. But everything about Facebook ultimately comes back to the fact that like some like hungover 22-year-old college student started it. And like that has just, it just keeps on like fanning out and having repercussions down the line because everything about it is like based on the fact that, like he woke up bleary eyed. He's like, I'm going to start Facebook today. And like everything at that point is just unfurled.
I never thought I'd put myself in the position of defending Mark Zuckerberg, but I have to admit that, you know, we didn't cover this story because who knows? This, you know, as soon as you have 500 million users and God knows how many billions of dollars, all of these guys are going to come out of the woodwork. I mean, who knows if there's any merit in this suit at all?
Right.
Right.
And then the other interesting little procedural aspect of it was that while Zuckerberg was at some, you know, industry confab in Aspen is when they decided to serve him. Yeah, although I guess they'd already served him, you know, somewhere in California and that would have been perfectly fine. But just as a publicity stunt, a process server walked in and handed him the summons.
At a meal, he said, yes. I'd like an autograph. Are you Mark Zuckerberg? And Mark said, yeah. He said, you're served.
Yeah, Evan, can you fathom a reason for doing that other than simply to get your name in the paper?
I thought they only did that in the movies.
Yeah,
it hardly ever happens. Yeah. I mean, most often service is, you know, such a cumbersome process that, you know, if you've got a lawsuit and you're going to serve it on someone, particularly on someone like Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, you're going to get in touch with them and say, hey, you know, we've got this lawsuit. It's been on file for a week or two. We're sending you a courtesy copy of it. We need to get you served.
That's what made the whole thing smelled fishy from day one. I'm not sure that there's a lot of merit in this case. I mean, who knows? But it just it smells a little bit.
Most people who are playing in the big leagues will ask that the defendant waive service, and I'm sure Facebook would do that, or counsel would accept service. Yeah. On the plaintiff's behalf. You know, I mean, I've been involved with, you know, representing some people who are pretty well known. And so, you know, we made sure to make it very clear well in advance that we would, waive service because we didn't want any antics like this, happening when our clients are in a public place.
At
it's
Allen
just silly.
Yep. Neelai, I'm going to have you be our resource of the week, not specifically you, but one of your posts about, speaking of Facebook, using lists to ensure your Facebook privacy. Can you tell us how you've decided to do that and what you recommended over on Engadget?
We launched this new part of our site called Alt, where we all think about stuff that isn't gadgets all the time. So one of the first pieces I read for Alt was this thing about Facebook lists. Which is a feature that Facebook has had forever, but it's actually like they don't tell you how to use it or what it's for or how to maximize it. And for me, you know, it's a real problem because a lot of people I don't know want to be my friend on Facebook. And I've had my Facebook page since I was a hungover 23-year-old law student. I have no idea what's on there at this point. It's years and years of my friends being my friends and us going to law school in Madison. So there you have it. So I really wanted to be able to, you know, sort of break down what I'm sharing with who. I want to share my personal stuff with my friends and some more family-related stuff with my families. You know, I'm work stuff with my colleagues and other people that I interact with. And then just sort of have people I don't know. And I realized, you know, the lists were the way to go. And then I sort of realized that I had figured this out and nobody else was really talking about it. So I put up this post being like, look, all you need is three lists in your life. And they really map well to your life. There's the people that you trust. There's sort of everybody else that you don't know well. And there's the people that you kind of want to keep away. And so make three lists and sort your friends onto them, and you will solve most of your problems. And you can, you know, people move between those lists. And I think it's interesting because we've talked about Facebook privacy. The last time I was on Twill, we talked about Facebook privacy. Mm-hmm. I don't think people have, you know, Facebook is bringing this out. I don't think people really have thought about how quickly others move in and out of roles in their life where, you know, I have friends from high school who were unquestionably the people I trust, you know, my closest friends who are now people I don't know very well. And that just sort of happened. And, you know, it's something that, you know, you maybe in the past you would wistfully think about, but now it's like, well, I got to take you off this list. Like, I got to think about this like all the time. And that's something. I mean, that's a big change, but it's something I think every Facebook user needs to do. I don't think you can go on Facebook and just leave everything hanging out. Everybody knows it's a bad idea. So, I mean, if it was up to me, if I was in charge of Facebook, I would say our new privacy system is we've given you three lists and you can customize them any way you want. But here are the three that you're starting with and we're requiring you to use them. And I think that would solve a lot of their privacy issues right off the bat, because then every friend of yours on Facebook, you would have had to put into one of your lists and you would have had to make a choice. And then the consequences of your choice are those consequences, and they're not Facebook's fault anymore. And I think that would really go a long way to solving their problems.
I can't tell you how happy I am not to have to even think about any of this. I do not miss Facebook at all.
Well, you know, but it's like, it's great. Like, I just went to my friend's wedding, and, you know, he rode down the street on a horse in Appleton, Wisconsin, and everybody, it was an Indian wedding. I don't know if that came through. It was a very elaborate affair. And, you know, everyone had pictures of it on Facebook, and we were talking about it. Like, that was, you know, it was a reminder of, like, the pure Facebook experience where you're sharing experiences with people that you know or that you've interacted with in person recently is actually very valuable. The stuff now, you know, where it's a lot of Engadget readers, they want to yell at me about the iPhone. Well, that's, I can do without that. But some, you know, Facebook is very valuable when it comes to actually interacting with people that you want to keep close to you, even though you might be far apart. Maybe I'm pie in the sky. What they really want to do is mine my personal information and sell things.
Let's face it. You've been sucked in by the promise.
Right. And Leo, for you, the benefits are not as great as for some of the rest of us. I mean, for your biggest problem is sort of filtering out the noise in your life to some extent.
There's plenty of ways you can find me online. Although I do encourage people to not rely on Facebook for their online presence because God only knows, you know, you could get booted off for any arbitrary reason or... You know, I mean, I think a lot of people do think, you know, this is my presence on the web. I think that's a perilous position to be in.
Right. Well, another perilous position to be in is to play a YouTube video recommended by the chatters. I think this was from Virgil.
I never do that.
that I haven't queued up because it would have just given us background noise in the show here. But it's circling back to our AntennaGate discussion at the beginning of the show. It's Darth Vader calls about his iPhone 4. And I think we should go ahead and just give that a twirl and see what happens.
Wonderful day. Thanks for calling. This is Wendy. How may I help you?
Da, da, da.
Excuse me, sir.
Da, 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 da.
Sir, excuse me.
Da, 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 da.
Sir?
Oh,
you're speaking away,
my bad.
Sir.
Just killing some time while I was on hold.
Not a problem. So what can I do for you today?
Yeah, I just got a couple of questions about my iPhone 4 and the whole antenna issue.
Absolutely, sir. The facts are that all phones have problems when gripped, and it's also true that the iPhone 4 drops less than one additional call per 100 than the previous iPhone 3GS.
Whoa. First off, you know, I watched the press conference last week, so you can stop reading from your whole little script there. And second, are you seriously defending the new phone by saying it almost performs as well as the old phone? Is that what the plan is?
Sir?
I think at this point we all know it's a design issue, and that is fine, but just admit it.
Sir, it's not a design flaw. The fact is that all phones have reception problems from time to time.
I'm sorry. Please don't say time to time like it's just an occasional issue. It's all the time, and worse yet, everyone knows it. I mean, I even got this idiot at work who's always doing the whole, hey, can you hear me now thing? And that guy's on a 4-year-old flip phone.
It's possible you're in a low signal area.
Well,
Burke, I think we get the idea here. Thank you so much. And thank you, Virgil, for the recommendation. And thank you all. Leo, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. This is the smartest show on Twit.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah. We enjoy it too.
Of course, everyone knows.
Leo, you're mostly on Buzz, right?
I buzz, I twitter, I buzz to Twitter, so I get on both, but yeah, Buzz is the place I really like to be. I keep foolishly promoting these alternatives to Twitter and Facebook, and they just never seem to take off.
Well, best of luck with it, and we'll just plug your Buzz feed. And
you just told me good luck with that, I think.
Well, you know, you're the last man on Buzz.
If anyone can do it, you can, Leo.
Good luck with that Buzz thing. Let me know how it works out, huh?
just start a Google Wave, see how that goes.
Oh, that'll work. Actually, this Sunday on This Week in Tech, I want to get a lawyer on if anybody wants to volunteer, because I really want to discuss this Flipboard issue. This is a very popular new iPad application that scrapes websites and happens to leave the ads behind.
I'm incensed about this, but I'll volunteer.
I bet Gadget's pissed. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not pissed. It's just, it's funny that they did this. I mean, I think the phrase that I used was they're going to get the pantsuit off of them. When it first came out. I mean, it's pretty intense what they're doing. I find it to be fascinating because I think the product is a good product and it's a good idea, but it's one of these Google moves, man. Let's throw it at the wall and see how the litigation.
As a consumer, I love it, but boy, as a content creator, I go, there's something wrong here, you know.
Right. And you know the attribution is all messed up too, so it doesn't show you who's writing what, even at the website level.
Yeah,
it's a lot of interesting issues there.
Email coming your way, Nile. We'll get you on that.
Absolutely.
Cool. We'll look forward to that on Twit, and maybe we'll talk about it on Twill next week too.
I'm sure you will.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Nile, it's a great pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks so much. Folks can find Nile, of course, at Engadget.com, and he is at Reckless on Twitter.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always a good time to be on the show.
All righty. And Evan Brown, of course, is at Internet Cases over there on Twitter. InternetCases.com is his excellent blog where he talks about all things internet law related. Thanks so much, Evan.
Well, thank you. This was a blast, don't you think?
I do think it was a blast. So really appreciate everyone's participation. And of course, we record live at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time on Fridays. So join us live at live.twit.tv. Jump into the chat at irc.twit.tv and check out our Facebook page before the show. That's at denise.howell.net/FB, where I post up questions and love to get your feedback on the topics we're going to discuss. So thanks, everyone. We'll see you on the next 12.